Hello and welcome to the Theology Mill podcast brought to you by Wipfenstock Publishers. My name is Zach Mickle. I'm on staff here at Wipfenstock and I'm the host of this podcast, which consists of interviews with leading authors and thinkers in theology, biblical studies, and philosophy. So on this episode, we hear from Dr. Andrew Remington Rilera on his new Cascade book, Lamb of the Free, Recovering the Varied Sacrificial Understandings of Jesus' Death. Andrew is an assistant professor of biblical studies and theology at the King's University in Edmonton, Alberta, in Canada. And then a quick side note before we jump to the interview, I want to make sure all of our listeners know the Theology Mill podcast will be on break for the summer. So that's summer 2024, as I'll be on paternity leave. So I will be away from the mic for a bit and spending some quality time with my daughters. So this will be our last episode before the break, but we will be picking things back up in the fall. And we do already have some really exciting interviews slated for the fall, so definitely be sure to keep your ear to the ground for those. And with that, thank you so much for listening, and I hope you enjoy this episode. Okay, so I am here with Dr. Andrew Remington Rilera, who is the author of the new Cascade book, Lamb of the Free, Recovering the Varied Sacrificial Understandings of Jesus' Death. So Andrew, thanks so much for coming on. As we kick things off, could you share with our listeners maybe just a bit about yourself, maybe what you do for work and what areas you're especially interested in as far as your research?
Yeah. Well, thanks for having me on. I appreciate the opportunity to get to talk about this book. I'm right now I'm an assistant professor of biblical studies and theology at the King's University in Edmonton, Alberta. But I'm a U.S. citizen, so made the trek up here in 2021 for the job after I defended my dissertation. So I guess I'm kind of all over the map research wise. Okay. I don't know if that's a probably more of a liability than an asset, depending on certain things. But so my dissertation was on Romans and getting into ancient rhetorical conventions and conversation with all, basically rhetorical conventions and trying to suss out from that angle the identity of the person Paul is addressing and arguing with in the beginning of Romans there. And I put that in conversation with Philonic Judaism, so Philo of Alexandria. And I have some articles on Daniel 7 in particular, Ephesians, and circumcision in Galatians and Philippians and Paul's opponents there that I also will link up with what I'm doing in Romans for Paul's interlocutor there, and how that relates to what I think some sort of relationship to Philo's form of Judaism and views of circumcision and kind of what is entailed and all that. And then I just wrote this book on sacrifice and sacrificial imagery. I got an article in the pipeline on Luke. So nice. I think it might be more of a function of my ADHD, but so blessing and a curse on that. But yeah, I have these pressing questions for myself that bug me, and I'm writing a lot to myself, I guess, of that, like trying to work stuff out, and the questions I can't get out of my head. And I'm lucky enough that I got to get 3 degrees in this while pursuing my questions, and then now it's part of my job, and I'm just thankful every day for my situation and trying to make the most of it.
Awesome. How's Alberta treating you? Did you get used to the winters yet, or I don't know what part of the country you're a U.S. citizen.
So Edmonton is pretty. I'm a U.S. Yeah, so I'm born, raised in Southern California.
Okay,
and Yeah, so it was actually, I was excited when the opportunity, like, not just for a job, but that it was in a hockey town. So Edmonton's pretty far up north. If you look at a map, it's like well above, like 6 hours above the Montana border there. And it's, so I grew up playing hockey and, you know, still play here. And so Alberta's treating us well. We like the weather. I was in Durham, North Carolina, while I was doing my doctorate at Duke, and the weather, I hated the weather in North Carolina. It looked very pretty, but man, I could do, we, the whole family, my whole family likes the winters here. We're skating outside and all that sort of stuff. It's just adventure time. I can't handle the humidity of North Carolina and all that. But yeah, so all that to say, it's fun. Got hockey, got sledding, tubing, skating, all kinds of stuff. Unfortunately, for anyone, any NHL fans out there, I've had to suffer 3 consecutive years of the Oilers knocking out the LA Kings in the first round of the playoffs. So going through a bit of a humiliation over here. But yeah, the only thing I got going for me is the Hurricanes, the Carolina Hurricanes, who we kind of adopted as a home away from home team while we were at in North Carolina. They're still in it. So got that going.
Nice. Well, what a blessing, honestly, to like land a tenure track job in a hockey town and in just a, you know, kind of a hockey region, like you're saying, because I know with tenure track jobs, it's kind of like, you know, more or less you take what you can get. But for someone who grew up playing hockey and loving hockey, that's awesome.
Oh, it's incredible. Yeah, it's made for good banter with colleagues and friends here and stuff, hockey stuff. And yeah, there's hockey all over the place. Like, yeah, there's rinks everywhere. I'm in good leagues here. Best hockey I've ever played in my life. So it's good.
That's awesome. Okay, so let's move to our opener question that we start all of our episodes with. So if you could place any three thinkers, dead or alive, together in a room and you could listen in on their conversation, which three thinkers would you choose and why?
You know, so listeners are aware, and I listened to Theology Meal, so I knew this was coming, and you told me it was coming, and it's just such a hard question. So, and everyone kind of hedges like this, right? Because it's just like impossible. So I have like a million names I have, but I think I've settled on these. And so I think I'd pick, I'm kind of cheating a little bit here. Sorry, of course. Okay, let me just, I was Barnabas. I'd go with Barnabas, number one. And the cheat was going to be / Silas, and that's because, we'll see. Basically they are a bridge, right? So they're from the Jerusalem church, but they're also with Paul, and I think Barnabas would give us, you know, a fair reporting. I trust Barnabas from his presentations there in the text to tell us kind of what's going on, not just with the different feuds or whatever, but I just think having someone who was close with Paul and then, you know, close to the Jerusalem church and all that, and just to kind of get to know what's going on there. But then I'm interested in the development of theology, doctrine, and the whole bit and how the unfolding of the revelation of Christ. So I would then pick Macrina the Younger, the Gregory of Nyssa's and Basil of Caesarea's sister. And that's because of the Cappadocian, you know, or like just all that theology and development in terms of universal reconciliation and the Trinity type debates going on, and just to kind of see like what would Barnabas think about what's going on, you know, with these developments, and kind of have like that anchor back, and she can explain, you know, what's going on in her time. And then I'd put a modern thinker in there with him who's able to accurately, or, you know, just very astutely bring to that table, you know, all the sorts of developments that have happened since. And I'm going to pick someone who might be surprising in terms of their status, but I think this person's going to really be, or already is, but is going to be a really key pivotal thinker going forward for a while. And that's Jordan Wood, who you all have had on before. And I just so captivated by his work on Maximus, and he's just so like, I want to be like Jordan when I grow up. That he is, he is a scholar and just in a, I think, someone like Jordan is able to bring to the table, a lot of the history of doctrine and modern, talk, of what's going on discourse, and to just be able to, so I just want to hear them all, like kind of hash out how this all works. The scripture relates to theology, what's going on with salvation, I mean, you know, all the big questions. I think those three people represent some key moments and are able to at least answer the questions I have that are kind of, like I said, they're kind of all over the place. So that's what I think, for sure.
And I know Jordan wrote an endorsement for your book, so it seems like the feeling must be mutual from what I can tell.
Oh, well, I don't know. Well, I appreciate that he actually reached out to me. And that was, yeah, I'm honored that he did that and, you know, read it and all that. Yeah, like I said, I think someone emailed me actually just yesterday, or was it the day before? I don't remember at the time of this recording, about they read Lamb of the Free and were having some questions. And one of them was just like, well, all right, what about constructive theology now? Like, you've kind of pulled a rug out from a lot of other the way a lot of theology gets developed and kind of unhinged. I don't mean that in the it kind of floats pretty high above the Bible. And that's one of the reasons I'd pick Jordan, that he knows the Bible really well. I mean, that's his undergrad, and he has such a breadth and depth of his knowledge and scholarship. So we'll listen to what Jordan has to say about things for a while. I think he's just a real gift to the church, and I'm excited to see what else he's putting out there.
Yeah, no, that's interesting what you said about you know what you're kind of doing in this book, undercutting, you know, some constructive theology. Because as I was reading the book, I was thinking something similar, but in regards to philosophy, because there's this whole conversation, or at least there has been this whole conversation in like continental philosophy around sacrifice. And as I was reading your book, I was kind of like, oh my gosh, that whole conversation is kind of operating, I don't know about on penal substitutionary atonement, but certainly sacrifice in the sense of substitution and with a focus on death. And what you're doing, drawing from several biblical texts, is kind of a very different view of sacrifice. So I think it, you know, could have lots of far-reaching consequences. That would be really interesting to see. So yeah. So speaking of which, let's get into PSA, penal substitutionary atonement, a little bit, because we'll be talking about that quite a bit, I imagine, in this conversation. So I think it might be good as we start to not assume that all of our listeners will have a working definition. So maybe for those who might not be familiar, or who just might need a refresher, or to hear your kind of understanding of it, how would you describe penal substitutionary atonement?
Yeah, so a key premise is for penal substitutionary atonement is that God has we'll call it a condition or a precondition for forgiveness. Cannot forgive sins unless there's a satisfaction of God's justice, which is understood. There's a lot of like moving parts here or interrelated things. God's justice is understood retributively, that is like inflicting of a penalty, whose the purpose of which, or the end, the goal, the telos, whatever word you want to put there, is punishment and suffering for its own sake, punishment and suffering per se. Once that is satisfied, then that allows God to justly forgive. If God forgives apart from meeting that condition, it's somehow arbitrary or unjust or something like that. So you have to satisfy the conditions of justice, and then it turns on this definition of justice that is the infliction of some punishment or penalty. So penal substitutionary atonement. So on that sort of like premise of what justice and how forgiveness can relate from the satisfying of those demands of justice, Jesus suffering in crucifixion is taken to mean that Jesus is suffering the wrath or justice of God, meeting that condition, suffering the wrath of God toward humanity as a substitutionary sacrifice. So there's the substitution and then the atonement. And it, everything kind of gets reduced and collapsed into a sacrificial metaphor there. And that's actually ironically one of the things I'm trying to do in my book is say there's so much in the New Testament about Jesus' death and the saving significance of Jesus as a whole, not just his death, mm-hmm. but that is extra sacrificial or non-sacrificial, since some other metaphor. I deal with that in the penultimate chapter there, chapter 7 in the book. Swing back to PSA. So they have that premise, and then the crucifixion is Jesus meeting those conditions, satisfying the demands of God's retributive justice on the cross in our place. So the substitution is in our place or instead of us or instead of believer, whoever. And that suffering satisfies, satiates God's preconditions to forgive, and so hence then atonement or salvation and all that. So basically Jesus' death is then, as I said, it's reduced to that singular metaphor of an atoning sacrifice. And from there, all sorts of things kind of cascade and problematically just kind of snowball. But Jesus' death takes the place of the punishment individuals ought to suffer for their sin. So in other words, penal substitutionary atonement names the cross as what those who benefit from Jesus' death necessarily get to escape and avoid, since it's construed as in our place or instead of us. And I just, if you'd indulge, I just can't help myself. So like, I as I argue in the book, that's just the opposite. Mm-hmm. Just to say it plainly, that's just the opposite of what so many New Testament passages say on several levels, let alone, like, forget for a second the Levitical sacrifice stuff, which I'll know we'll get to, but just the function of Jesus' death. The consistent message in the entire New Testament is not that Jesus died instead of us, and this is a thing I kind of repeat in there, and it kind of got it came to me as a tweet years ago or whenever, I forget if we looked at my history, but Jesus didn't die instead of us, but ahead of us, so that we can unite with him and be conformed to the image of his death. I mean, this is all over the place in the New Testament, like literally almost every single text, except for maybe Jude. I should probably have read that before I made this, because it takes me 5 seconds, but maybe excluding Jude, but you know, it's in First Peter, it's in Romans, Galatians, Philippians, it's all over the place. Yeah. Like I said, it's the gospel is pick up your cross, all this. And then the crucifixion is just explicitly said. So let me just give an easy example here. And in Acts 4, the apostles are speaking about, you know, pondering what the heck's going on with this is a little bit, you know, into the after the ascension, and there's been a few speeches and all that. But in Acts 4, they quote, it's Peter, I believe. I should probably pull up my Bible here. I can't remember if it's Peter or it's all like this kind of united voice. Oh, I'm looking at it now. Yeah, it's like everyone. So they're all gathered, and they quote from Psalm 2 and explain the crucifixion, you know, to the audience or whatever. So quoting Psalm 2 in Acts 4. And what's interesting is they say the crucifixion is Jesus suffering the insolent rage of humanity toward God. Like, it's right there in Psalm 2. And this is what's quoted again in Acts 4. It's toward God. Now, like, I do believe, one of the reasons I want Macrina and Jordan Wood together with Barnabas, do believe and affirm the Trinity, but I'm not making a Trinitarian claim here, and I don't think Acts is right in this place either. It's toward God. The crucifixion is humanity's injustice toward God, precisely because it's toward another human being, and especially it's toward God's anointed. And so we learn all over the place in the Bible, Old Testament, New Testament, Proverbs. There's a Proverbs 14:31, 17:5, 19:17. This idea that if you oppress the poor, you're taunting their maker. If you're gracious to them, you're honoring God, or you're lending to God. If you mock the poor, you're taunting their creator. And Jesus' teaching, like in 1 John 5, if you love the parent and you love the child, like how you treat other people is how you're treating God. And even then that gets spun around into how you're treating Christ. Even so, maybe they're starting to hint at a bit more, some sort of a quasi, well, just proto, whatever, some sort of divine identity there of Jesus, Matthew 25, and the way Jesus talks about Paul's persecution. Why are you persecuting me? So to crucify, you know, to stone someone, to withhold the goods of life, that's 1 John 3, from someone else, from another human, is an expression of humanity's enmity toward God. So an injustice toward other people is an expression of our enmity and hostility toward God. And that's exactly what Jesus experienced on the cross. And that's exactly how Acts frames it. It's Jesus, they take Psalm 2, or just that the nations are gathered in insolent rage against the Lord. So it's against God and against his anointed. And so he names Herod, Pontius Pilate, or they, Herod, Pontius Pilate, along with the nations and the peoples of Israel, in Acts 4 there, and in their insolent rage and anger, crucified him. And so it's important in verse 28 there, Acts 4, 28, this didn't catch God or Jesus off guard, but it says like they knew it would happen, but Jesus is just definitely not experiencing the rage of God. He's enduring the insolent rage of humanity, of the nations, their injustice toward God as God's anointed one. And so when it says, you know, some of the proof text for penal substitution, like, oh, God did not spare his own son. Well, that's not that the God is wrathing out on Jesus. It's that God did not refuse to enter into solidarity with creation as a human being, knowing full well. So that's Acts 4:28, also, you know, Romans 8, knowing full well that we humans in our enmity and injustice would torture and kill him. Yet he still reconciles. He still rectifies. So that's how I'd probably translate dikaiosune, or dikaio, the verb there, to rectify rather than justify. And God is rectifying, God is reconciling, God is saving. This is Romans 5. And this is all demonstration, Paul says, of God's love, not of God's wrath. And you're asking me about penal substitution, and there's so many issues before we even get to the sacrificial bits. Like, there's just so many things, and this is like an overwhelming emphasis. That's part of what motivates me, is that it's not just about a proof text here and there about, oh, well, you could take this differently. And I know people are probably thinking about Suffering Servant right now, and I might just have you wait for the book for that one. It's a big no. That is not, you know, and you know, there's like a detailed bunch of reasons for that, but like, just to get like there's so many passages that not just talk about the crucifixion of Jesus as what he endured from humanity's side. I mean, Paul says this in 1 Corinthians 2 as well. The rulers of this age that put him to death, and had they known what they were doing, 1 Corinthians 2:8, they wouldn't have crucified the Lord of glory. So, not only is it, you know, framed as humanity's enmity and as an expression of humanity's enmity and injustice toward God, toward another human, toward God's anointed. Also, as I just alluded to, Romans 5, but then this is John 3:16, 1 John 3:16. That's a John 3:16. I want the whole world to memorize 1 John 3:16. Probably read into verse 18. This is the demonstration of God's love and what that means. In how we then relate to others, to other people. And so Romans 8 repeats this over and over again, the love of God, the love of God, the love of God that's in Christ, and nothing can separate us. So all this is an act of God's love. And paradoxically, also, I should probably say this too, sorry, again, this is, you guys are getting an inside look into what it looks like for a scholar with ADHD to start to have a microphone. I haven't had a podcast in a while, so... this is also why I keep to strict PowerPoints when I teach, because I have to keep myself okay. Anchored. all right. So God's love. Oh, wrath. Okay. So my issue, I don't have, like, again, I want people to read the book, right? So I don't want them to listen to this and then think, oh, great. Here comes he's like a Oprah type scholar, and he thinks God's too nice to have wrath against humanity's injustice and all that. And that's not, that's not the case at all. I use the phrase a few different times there, that if we want to kind of have in certain texts, not an overarching, but in certain texts that explain Jesus' death, it's cursed solidarity. So I said, cursed solidarity, atonement, and maybe we'll talk about the definition of atonement. But for right now, I mean, atonement, non non-sacrificially. I just mean it more in the terms of reconciliation, broader. So not a sacrificial term, but cursed, solidarity, atonement. So Jesus is experiencing the curses of the covenant, which parallel the curses overlaying all of creation from Genesis 3. And so there is an element of, if you want to use the language of God's wrath, in there, but how that's framed is pretty, it's important how we're framing God's wrath within a covenant framework, where the curses of the covenant themselves, as they're presented in the Torah and Leviticus and in Deuteronomy and in the prophets, the curses are nothing if not Israel enduring the communal disintegration and suffering that results from injustice within Israel. Hmm. And than the injustice of the peoples outside of Israel on them. So the curses of the covenant that are somehow related to the wrath of God and sin is this picture depiction of when we are disobedient to God's laws, right? What is that? Well, that means that we're failing to love our neighbors as ourselves. We're failing to treat them the way the Proverbs outlines, Jesus' teachings, others, as we're failing to do justice to fellow humans. And that necessarily will drag us down into the curses of death, not the blessings of God's life. So even though Jesus is suffering the curses of joining in solidarity with the curses and the covenant death that humanity is under, that Israel is under in a particular way, given their calling and election, this is not just like a Zeus type picture of God. I don't even know if I understand Zeus right, but go with the metaphor for a second, of him just like, of God being like Zeus, just lightning bolting, sending lightning, you know, and just zapping someone or zapping Jesus instead of us. So the wrath of God is related. I definitely think Jesus is enduring the curses of the covenant, but it's not framed in the way penal substitution likes. So with certain caveats, I have no problem with the penal part of penal substitutionary atonement, provided it properly framed within the covenant. And I try to do that, you know, in the book at those places. But yeah, so yeah. Just to head off that objection, I'm not trying to give this picture of like there's God's too nice or something like that.
We
understand that's a bit more detailed, and that's why I wrote the book. So I'll just actually, one more. I don't want people to think this is a straw man either. So, and this is, I think, is free on the website. You can download the intro, and in the intro, I highlight a used to be prominent evangelical scholar who's now suffered disgrace. And so I'm kind of hesitant to say his name, but it's on the first couple of pages in the intro. But I'll quote from what they say in terms of how they're setting up penal substitution, then it'll relate to sacrifice. So hopefully it'll kind of segue better. They say, God cannot just forgive. So to wrap this up, you know, like what's penal substitution? What's at stake here? How do we get back into this sacrificial dialogue? They say, this is a quote, God cannot just forgive our sins without anyone suffering. Okay, so end quote. The basis for this is, quote again, the elaborate sacrificial system of the Torah, which was ordained by God to symbolize this fundamental reality, end quote. And then he later calls this, quote, the logic of justice. So this is what I'm trying to untangle. And this is a pretty, like I said, used to be prominent, evangelical scholar, and it's actually more tame. So I'm not just going after some of the like more barbarous expressions of this stuff. But what's the problem with those three claims, right? God cannot just forgive, right? That's what I was saying before, that premise of like, okay, there's some sort of condition of satisfaction, right? Then it's relating it to the sacrificial system, and the key word there is suffering, without anyone suffering. So that view then says, oh, when you go back and read the Torah's sacrificial system, this is about depicting this fundamental reality. And that's what they said, the quote, fundamental reality, that forgiveness is based on suffering. And otherwise, God can't forgive. And that this is justice. So I'm trying to untangle all that, because I don't think the Old Testament or New Testament views of sacrifice have anything to do with justice per se. But many Christians, like this scholar, you know, in deriving their views from these sorts of claims, they have a view of justice from a mistaken understanding of sacrifice in our canon, in our scriptural canon. So if justice is retributive and has to do with punishment and suffering, then sacrifice is construed as bringing justice by punishing some other blood-filled mammal as a substitutionary death. And that substitutionary death and that suffering is construed as the just punishment for the sinner in their stead, instead of them. Therefore, they're forgiven. And then you see this writ large in the crucifixion. So I think there's just so many knots there to not just disentangle, but just problematic equations. And that's why, you know, takes a however many pages this book is, almost pushing 300 to clarify. So there, that's where we're at.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm curious, where does PSA come from? Like, what's the history of penal substitutionary atonement? Because I think I don't know where our listeners are coming from, but like for me, growing up, probably well into like my mid-20s or at least early 20s, I was completely unaware that there was any other idea of the atonement that was not penal substitutionary atonement. You know what I mean? I just that was what I had always been taught, and I thought that was clearly and straightforwardly obviously you have like the ransom theory and stuff that kind of can get mixed in there as well, or it could, at least in the churches I grew up in. But I'm curious if you could say a little bit, you know, did this do you feel like, obviously it sounds like it's not emerging in your view kind of straightforwardly, at least from the biblical text, but was this present in the church fathers? Was this sort of a result of the Reformation, or when do you kind of see this emerging, or what are kind of the historical circumstances in which this emerged?
Yeah, well, there's obviously modern proponents of penal substitutionary atonement are gonna, you know, not just go back and from the Reformation, definitely it's there in John Calvin, but they're gonna push it back and say, oh, it's there in Anselm, and it's also there in some patristics, and oh, it's also there in the New Testament. You know what? It's also there in Isaiah 53. You know what? It's also there in Leviticus. That's what that quote was saying. Like that. Mm-hmm. And so they try to push it all the way back. And so my training, I'm a PhD in New Testament with a couple of minors and Second Temple Judaism and theology, but so I'm talking outside, I'm not a historical theologian, so I'm talking outside of my doctoral training here. So just, you know, listener beware. The reason, so I go to the Bible because that's my training, and that's where, you know, a lot of penal substitutionary people ultimately want to anchor their views in, which is understandable for a lot of, you know, Protestants, right? The authority of the Bible and all that.
Yeah.
But I think I'll just, like, when it comes to the patristics, similar to how I think a lot of folks are reading the New Testament in this vein, the penal substitutionary umbrella, they're not reading carefully enough. And like where they find substitution, I think a lot of these places, it's actually the concept of solidarity and participation going on. That Jesus is doing, he's taking on our conditions fully. And it's a whole incarnational claim. It's not just about his death. I mean, sorry, not just about his birth, but all the way up until his life and his death and his bodily resurrection and ascension, that whole, the whole of Jesus's incarnational life is a sharing. There's a double participation going on, which is a phrase I also use in the book. And so I'm not convinced it's there. And a lot, I mean, I'm sure there might be some random stuff, but a lot of the proof texts I've seen for folks saying, oh, there's penal substitution and Athanasius or whatever, mm-hmm. I think make better sense as within your context and a broader theology as fully embedded within a paradigm of participation and solidarity. I mean, this is what becomes the criterion for orthodoxy, and what makes something a matter of orthodoxy or heresy is whether or not it hinders a conception of salvation as theosis, or, you know, full conformity to the image and likeness of God is revealed in Jesus. And so the death of Jesus is squarely within this paradigm as a pattern and shape of the sanctified life. and it's not being activated in a way that says, oh, thank God, we don't need to do that. And like, do you save this from that? And in fact, this is what, you know, Ignatius, is that my thing? Yeah. Ignatius in his letters, I know there's also my doctoral advisor has some thoughts on those letters, mm-hmm. but whoever wrote those letters, Douglas Campbell, with the kind of emerging Docetism. So this view that Jesus only seemed to be human, wasn't fully, didn't actually suffer all this stuff. What was understood, I think, by all is that however you depict Jesus, like, that's what you're supposed to be like. So if you don't want to suffer, you can't have a suffering Jesus. Yeah, it can't be human. Yeah. Can't be. And yeah. So, you know, there's like this assumption that like, we're supposed to be like this guy. So, you know, we'll remake him to how we want to be. In Ignatius, there's this, the heresy of Docetism is that it would, if Jesus wasn't actually human, Jesus didn't actually suffer, Jesus didn't actually die, then we're, you know, we're free from those sorts of obligations in a sense of how we are inhabiting this unjust world in a manner like Christ. So I think that just demonstrates that a lot of what's motivating these early patristic theologies is a very thick understanding of salvation as transformation into the image and likeness of Christ. And now we see, you know, scholars like Michael Gorman and others saying like, oh yeah, this view, like that, like they didn't just make this up. This is in the New Testament. And mm-hmm. that's kind of what's, you know, generated my stuff. But I want to talk about Anselm for a second, because it's plain that, that John Calvin for sure is like the guy. There's some debate about whether Luther might have some hints or bits of that, but really it's Calvin. And what Calvin does, and again, not a historical theologian, not a Calvin scholar, take this with a huge grain of salt. Again, that's why I focus my book on the Bible. So Calvin is, that's my training, but I don't know if Calvin, so I could be wrong here on this bit. I know he definitely like appeals to Anselm. I don't know if he's saying like, like Anselm already said this, or if he is consciously like updating, so to speak, like revising mm-hmm. Anselm's framework. And so whatever. So Calvin, I would say it really starts with him, at least in all the varieties that have then existed from after Calvin. You'll get a lot of scholars who this is fascinating. Like some of these redescriptions of penal substitutionary atonement, it really like is just mystifying, because some of these articulations I don't think actually count as penal substitutionary atonement anywhere. Yeah. They've redescribed one term or the other in such a way to save it from being the divine child abuse type view that like, yeah. It's like, all right, you're saying this is penal substitutionary atonement. Maybe that's like for yourself or for your job. I don't know. Whatever. It could be cynical, yeah. Like for whatever reason, like at the end of the day, you look at it and go, that's not, you have another framework, like mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. good, like okay, fine. I'm good with that, because you're recognizing these problems. I don't know why you're retaining that phrase. I just like, it's not, there's nothing sacred about that phrase. Mm-hmm. And again, unless you're in certain institutional context. But okay, so here's what I think is going on, though. It's fascinating, is those redescriptions, they actually get at what Anselm makes. He makes this point at the beginning of his famous treatise, Why God Became Human. Or I don't know how to pronounce Latin, so I'm not going to try, because I wasn't trained in Latin, but Why God Became Human. So it's Anselm's favorite book. And a lot of people, there's a continued thought that Anselm is like the father of penal substitutionary atonement. And that's not true. Like, he has a satisfaction theory of atonement I'll talk about in a second, but yeah. I knew we were going to talk about Anselm, so I pulled up these quotes. And what's fascinating is that there's just no way that someone can think Anselm holds the penal substitutionary atonement or something like a proto penal substitutionary atonement theology. There's no way they read him, because Anselm cuts this option off right off the bat in this treatise. It's in book one, chapter 8, and it's like pretty quick in there. So if you just take 5 minutes to start reading it before you even get bored, you already know what Anselm's not saying. And I, you know, so maybe this is proof that, you know, some people did think this back then, and Anselm's trying to correct them, because the way this treatise is set up is as a dialogue between him and, I don't know how to pronounce this dude's name, but it's Boso, and sounds like bozo to me, which has its own funny implications in English, but I don't know, maybe it's bosso. I have no idea. Anyway, so his interlocutor, we'll call him bozo because why not? Feeling salty. So Anselm says, he says that God, so here, quote, God the Father did not treat that man, Jesus, as you, so bozo, apparently understand him to have done, nor did he hand over an innocent man to be killed in place of the guilty party. That is penal substitutionary atonement. And he says, right off the bat. I have more, though, because this gets good. So then Bozo states, even if this is just perfect, again, because, man, people just need to read the sources, all right? So Bozo says, because I know what people of penal substitutionary atonement are going to say the exact things Bozo here said comes to rebuttal. He says, even if it is not against the will of Christ, since he consented to the will of the Father, it nevertheless seems that the Father did coerce him through the instructions he gave him. For it is said in Scripture that Christ, quote, humbled himself, becoming obedient even to death. So Bozo's stating Philippians 2:8 there. Mm-hmm. And the Son says the same in Gethsemane. I have not come to do my own will, but the will of him who sent me. And in another place, Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not in accordance with my will, but yours. Everywhere here, it is apparent that Christ endured death under the compulsion of obedience rather than through the intention of his free will. So Anselm then replies to this. He says, you are not drawing a proper conclusion. It seems to me between, on the one hand, what Christ did because of the demands of his obedience, and on the other, the suffering inflicted upon him because he maintained his obedience, which he underwent even though his obedience did not demand it. So then Bozo later asserts, it is evident that if the man had not sinned, God ought not to demand death from him. To which Anselm responds. So it seems here, by the way, in the dialogue, Bozo doesn't like think this. He thinks this is what Anselm's saying. And Anselm's trying to correct it. Right, so Anselm responds, God, therefore, did not force Christ to die, there being no sin in him. Rather, he, that is Jesus, underwent death of his own accord, not out of an obedience consisting in the abandonment of his life. That is, so this is me now trying to interpret that. Jesus wasn't obedient to a demand from God that he must die a substitutionary death, innocent in place of the guilty, what Anselm kind of headed when I first started this quote with. So that's not what the obedience was, but it's out of an obedience. So back to Anselm, but out of an obedience consisting in his upholding of righteousness so bravely and pertinaciously that as a result, he incurred death. So Anselm does not think, I mean, it's very, he says it straight up. He does not think Jesus needed to die a sinner's death. He says, God did not hand over an innocent man to be killed in place of the guilty party. All right. So what Christ offered to God on humanity's behalf, according to Anselm, was not the punishment of sin, right? That's not his satisfaction. It was the honor due God through faithful obedience. And this is also interesting for anyone familiar with the Pistis Christi debate, the subjective or objective genitive there. Is it faith of Christ or faith in Christ, by the way? Anyways, so for Anselm, Jesus isn't really a sacrificial death. That's not what's happening there. That's not what's being satisfied. It's not the punishment of sin or anything like that. It's rather an obedient life all the way to the point of death. Never stop being obedient. And this is actually remarkably consistent with Philippians 2:8, Romans 5, this one act of righteousness, obedience, and Hebrews as well, learned obedience to what it suffered. Jesus satisfies God's honor by giving him the honor due from humanity. And Jesus' death is then more of a display of the full dedication of Jesus to remain obedient to the Father. That is the debt that humanity owed God. That debt was obedience or honor, not enduring some kind of punishment. And so Jesus was offering obedience, you know, so it's nothing. Anselm's recoiling at the view that the Father would punish the Son. And the cross is not Jesus experiencing hell or something like that on humanity's behalf. It's just the full dedication of Jesus' obedience to the Father. And so I wanted to say that because it's just it's a nice little case study of like, folks, read the sources, please. Some of the, whether you agree with Anselm or not, even it's like, just let's read the sources. And if you don't know what you're talking about, like I was saying with John Calvin or whatever, just like hedge, you know, I don't know.
Yeah,
I don't know
that
without Calvin. And say, but like, anyways, so Anselm did not like penal substitution atonement, whatever you think about his other stuff and his more positive account. And I think people resonate with that, though, critique. And so some of these redescriptions of penal substitutionary atonement are almost getting back more to what Anselm is denying, right? They're like, yeah, this is weird. We don't want that. And so, but for whatever reason, they're retaining the phrase. And I think there's other problems with the phrase. So, I mean, that is, again, there's several layers to all this discussion. But
yeah, absolutely. I wanna turn to, because I think those first few chapters of your book, you're doing some really kind of rich biblical exegesis, particularly of the Hebrew Bible, particularly of the sacrificial system as it's kind of laid out in the Hebrew Bible. So I'm curious, what would you say are some of maybe the biggest misunderstandings about the kinds of sacrifices that we find specifically in the Old Testament?
Where do I start? So I guess I'll start with where I think I start this in the chapter. So there's no sacrifice isn't substitutionary death. And I explain this from a few different, like often throughout the book, but I have a little subsection on this in chapter one, I believe, right off the bat. And this can be observed like pretty quickly. Again, there's other corroborating evidence for this, but I kind of make, yeah. So it's not a substitutionary death. And one of the easy ways to see this is that whenever the sacrifices rectify something, they have a function, right? And I'll talk about that in a second. Now, there's several different types of sacrifices, they have different functions. Okay, but we know one of the functions is some sort of dealing with sins in some way. And again, there's more to this. So, but one of those things, it cannot rectify, it cannot be the address, cannot handle, it's beyond its scope, is when the life of the offerer is on the line. This is explicit in the Torah. Whenever there's a situation in which the offense calls for either capital punishment or being cut off, those are actually two subtly distinct different things. I don't want to, I'm already saying too much, I think, details. So there's distinctions there between those two, but either way, the life of the offerer is forfeit for certain circumstances, and you cannot offer a sacrifice for those things. And that rules out the idea that whatever is going on in Levitical sacrifice, it cannot be that it's substituting for the death of the offerer, because that's the precise situation in which you cannot offer a sacrifice. So if substitutionary death was the logic of what's going on in animal sacrifice, then the one thing that would definitely be remedied by a sacrifice would be when your life is on the line. And so there's an easy one. I mean, I go through other things, but that's one of them. So the other bit is, again, hand laying. I know people that, I think that's the next subsection there. Like, what about hand laying? Well, read the book. Okay. I'll tell you the conclusion, but how you get you gotta read to get the details. But basically there's a difference between a single hand laying and a double hand laying. Right. And, single hand laying is what happens to certain sacrifices, not all of which are the atoning ones. And in fact, one of the atoning ones, the asham, the reparation offering, does not require a hand gesture. And that one has atoning significance and all that. So again, it's not, there's the function there is ownership. This is mine. And it also is done with the well-being sacrifices, of which there's three subcategories, and these have their function is not atoning. And so the double hand laying happens with I got this from Roy Gain, the tote goat in the day of decontamination or the day of atonement. And so the double hand laying happens on the goat that is not slaughtered. So anyways, hand laying, it's not substitution. It's not laying on sand or anything like that. That happens in one ritual. And I explain all that in great detail on the day of decontamination, but it's not substitutionary death. It's not substitutionary. And then it's not substitutionary death, nor is it about suffering either, sacrifice that is. And so, I'm leaning on Christian Eberhardt, David Moffat, Jacob Milgram, a lot of others. A lot of what I'm doing is connecting dots. Like I'm not, there's very small places where I'm offering a pretty novel interpretation of some things, but largely what I'm doing is just connecting dots that need to be connected. The sacrifice is never about punishing the sacrificial animal with death in place of the offerer. That's just, that's a big misunderstanding there. The other one is that, as I kind of, said with the substitutionary death thing, there's God-ordained limits to what atoning sacrifices can address. So I'll probably say more about that as we move along here. But yeah, I think the biggest thing is that there's atoning and non-atoning sacrifices and what the function of atonement is. I'm sure we'll talk about later. And then there's limits to what even the atoning sacrifices can address. And those all are very important for understanding then the prophetic expectation of restoration and all that sort of thing and what the New Testament's proclaiming about Jesus.
Sure. Okay, so then if the liturgical sacrifices are not about substitutionary death or suffering, as you're saying, then what exactly are they about? Like what would you say is their function?
So there's two main functions, I think, again, drawing on others. The first, and I'd say even the primary, again, not just me, but just in the book, the primary function is sacred meal, meaning the purpose of a sacrifice is offering a gift always conceptualized as food. So sometimes you'll get phrases about the priests in Leviticus or Numbers that they offer the food of our God. They're offering Yahweh's food. And it's always a metaphor because God's not, and I have, the details on this in the book, but God's not literally eating the sacrifice, but there's a consumption going on there. Right. And it's a shared sacred meal. So you have one that's just for God. That's the whole burnt offering. It's like God gets it all. So the whole thing goes up. That's his. Then you get the well-being sacrifices, which, as I said, they subdivide. We don't really need to get to those divisions, but these ones, again, nothing to do with sins. They're celebratory. They're commemorating some sort of deliverance usually. Or God, like you said, hey, if I have a successful business venture, I come back from this trip, like I'm going to throw a feast. So you throw a sacred feast and you eat in celebration and joy and rejoicing, and it's you're eating. So it's a shared meal between the priest, the offerer, and God. And so that's the ideal setup. In fact, the rabbis say that in the world to come, everything else, you have no need for atonement. But we are going to still be doing the well-being sacrifices because that's just sharing. So sometimes in translations they're called communion, the fellowship offerings, the communion offerings, the peace offerings sometimes it's called. But yeah, it's this idea of sacred feasting with God. So now though, what you introduce, okay, if God's in the sacred space, so he has like a house and it's like a house kitchen, a house restaurant. So this is God's, the dining room's got a table, it's got lamps, bread, and there's the drink offerings and stuff, and incense smells pretty. And what happens though when that holy God is plopped in the midst of impurities and contaminations of various sources? Well, you need to clean it, right? This restaurant needs to maintain its grade A health score so everyone can keep doing these sacred feasts. And so that's where the atoning sacrifices come in. So the first function would be sacred meal. The second one is decontamination of this dwelling, the sanctuary, this God's house and kitchen. And the priests are like the butchers and the waiters, cooking the food and serving it and all that, and then cleaning it and maintaining its grade A holiness score. So and then with that function of decontamination, there's two sources, generally speaking, of contamination. Get it from what we call in biblical scholarship ritual impurity, which is not related to sin. It's not a sin to be ritually impure. In fact, you're probably going to be impure like almost every day, and most impurities go away at night after a bath. So take a bath, and then after sunset you're good to go. That's when the sacrifice restaurant closes at sunset, opens at dawn, And so once it closes, you know, you're good for the next day, provided you don't have another source of impurity. Some of them need a atoning sacrifice. Some ritual impurities need an atoning sacrifice, and that's because the ritual impurity exceeds the person's body and get and leaches out and attaches onto the sanctuary. So you need a way to decontaminate that sacred space. And the other, so ritual impurity causes contaminations, and this is from birth to death to certain skin diseases, certain genital discharges, natural and unnatural. People are always surprised to learn in my classes. You know, they've been, most of them, somehow aware of menstruation causing ritual impurity, and a lot of them don't realize they'll seminal emissions do as well. So it's not like anyway, so there's all kinds of and I relate these to the beginnings and endings, following some of Jonathan Clowin's work of human life, that where ritual impurity is basically a marker of human finitude, of beginnings and endings, and associations with either our birth and or death. And so you, ritually speaking, separate yourself from that to come into the presence of the infinite God of life. And so separate ourselves from our death, finitude, and all that sort of stuff. The other one is sin contamination. So that is usually like, oh yeah, duh. Yeah, sin contaminates stuff. But the problem with this is that not all sins contaminate equally. So there are certain types of sins that produce an overwhelming amount of sin contamination that is beyond the capacity, the built-in, God-ordained capacity and scope of what the atoning, or kippur in Hebrew, which I'll probably be using going forward, to just elide the use of how atonement just means way too many things, which I flag in the introduction. There's problems with that word because it, anyways. Okay. So sin contamination, a certain sins, these are the categories some scholars call moral impurity. And they use that because it is an impurity, but, that Leviticus uses, but it's in the back half of Leviticus, Leviticus 18 and following. And these sins are related to idolatry, sexual immorality, and, murder. And those ones defile not just the sanctuary. So these other sins defile the sanctuary. These ones defile the person and the land. These are the two things atoning sacrifices, kippur sacrifice, cannot decontaminate. And so there is a limit. So the two functions, sacred meal, decontamination, but even within that decontamination, to get two sources of contamination, ritual impurity, things related to the forces of death, as Matthew Thiessen's great book outlines, also following Jacob Milgram, and I use it a lot in mine as well, Matthew Thiessen's book, that is, and Milgram. And then sin contamination. But in sin contamination, there's this extra level where if sin's in that moral impurity category, or categories, those three, murder, idolatry, sexual morality, these defile a person and the land, and they have no kippur sacrifice. And this is why Leviticus is all like emphatic about these. This is what leads to exile. The only remedy is the death of the offender and or exile of the community. So the land can only heal given sufficient time with the removal of the impurity that is the morally impure from the land. And so, and I don't know if I want to say more about that, but those are, so that's what the Levitical sacrifices are about. Maybe I should say, why is blood being used a little bit? Again, there's a lot of sections on this, or a lot of words I use, space devoted to this, but basically, Leviticus 17, is crucial, very, very crucial, as actually, ironically, everyone will admit, Leviticus 17 is crucial, for understanding sacrifice. Problem is, people just, you know, again, don't just read that one verse, Leviticus, in 17, it's read the whole thing. So this is some stuff I deal with in chapter one, as well, and throughout, but blood symbolizes life, and it's not a substitutionary life. So I can't really, but, I don't want to take up too much time on this point. It is very important, but it's so important that I don't really know how to adequately summarize it for now, to say that blood is representing life, and you cannot bring death into the presence of God. This is what generates ritual impurity. So there's a ritual way that Leviticus handles the obvious death of the animal, right? The biological fact, the animal dies. But so it counts as bloodshed. It says you are guilty of shedding blood. Leviticus 17, 3-5. I think it's verse 4 that specifically says this. If you kill an animal to eat, whatever, and you do not offer it as a sacrifice, then it counts as shedding blood. It counts as if your blood guilt, as if you same as murder. And the only way it becomes, so that's a death, right? The only way it becomes not that and becomes a means of accessing life is if you go through these proper blood rituals. And this even applies to game, just the depository is the ground and earth rather than the altar. Then it becomes life, right? You've reoriented, reconceptualized this event from being an obvious like biological killing of an animal to it being about the presentation of life. And death is no more coming into the presence of God. It's just life. And so because it's the forces of death that generate impurity and sin contamination, you need pure life to overwhelm those forces of death. And that's what consecrates and cleanses, decontaminates the space so that everyone can have their sacred meals again in God's presence. So you're bringing life into God's presence, not death. And these atoning sacrifices can only remove contaminations from the sanctuary, not from people's bodies, not from the land. And this is why the prophetic hope of moral purification is analogized to the rituals of cleansing bodies from ritual impurity, which comes through water washing and the passing of time, rather than sacrifices. So when the Psalms or prophets talk about, you know, what is needed to heal, you know, the people and the world, it's not a big giant, just a really the best atoning sacrifice or whatever. It's actually a divine washing through the Spirit, and hence baptism and stuff. Mm-hmm. In the New Testament, there's all kinds of, you know, baptisms and immersions for ritual purification. But yeah, so the sacrifices are of those two types: meal, decontamination, and then what's being decontaminated is not the people and is not the land. And so you need another mm-hmm. remedy for those things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, thank you. I mean, it is dense and intricate territory, but it's really, really helpful to hear you lay it out, even if you're having to do it and like you said, in way too condensed a time. Okay. So relating all of this to Christ's sacrifice, right? To the atonement that we think of with Christ's passion. How would you describe the relationship between the Old Testament sacrifice, kind of sacrificial system that you're talking about, and then the passion of Christ as it's sort of described and interpreted in the Gospels and the New Testament writings?
big question.
Yeah.
So following David Moffat again and Christian Eberhard, just so people know I'm not just making stuff up on my own. I mean, maybe we're all making stuff up. Okay. The passion, like the suffering of Christ, the suffering crucifixion, death qua death, suffering as suffering, is not at all related to sacrificial metaphors. That's what I did, you know, all that front work in the book. Mm-hmm. So when it comes to understanding Jesus' death, we have to attend to these distinctions and subtleties. And I hope I lay that out well enough in my chapters there, beginning in chapter 5 and 6 as we get into the New Testament of Jesus' death. So when suffering qua suffering or death qua death is the emphasis of a New Testament writer, then it is removed. Like we don't get sacrificial metaphors there. Mm. Because that's not how sacrifices function. The sacrificial understandings of Jesus' death don't occur in those contexts of Jesus' suffering and passion per se. So I'll talk about the Lord's Supper in a second, because that's what people are probably thinking about. Yeah. But when Jesus' sufferings, right, the sacrificial metaphors are avoided in those contexts. And again, Moffat's demonstrated this in great detail and Eberhard and I tried to as well. But the other thing is, so there are, obviously, I wrote this, but there are sacrificial metaphors. So what are they doing? And one of the things that I think I'll also say is when atonement is activated, so the kippur, the decontamination aspect, this is actually, again, following Moffat, I see this in 1 John and Hebrews, it is associated not with Jesus' death, crucifixion, but with his resurrected and ascended bodily presence before the Father. So what I just said about, you know, the sacrificial system, you're bringing life into the presence of the Father. Well, this is how then 1 John Hebrews conceptualized Jesus in relation to atonement, because he has life, his indestructible life, as Hebrews says, is bodily resurrected. Life is before the Father. That is a decontamination. That his resurrected life is the most purgative, potent substance in the cosmos to decontaminate the heavenly sanctuary in Hebrews 9. It explicitly says he's decontaminating the heavenly sanctuary there. Mm-hmm. So, but I want to talk about the passion of Christ, like the sufferings of Christ, because the way the Lord's Supper, if you remember when I said about the well-being sacrifices and all that, these are the ones to eat. So the Lord's Supper is a meal, right? So Passover and New Covenant, or just covenant inaugurations or renewals, are communal well-being sacrifices. These are ones the offerers, everyone enjoys a meal. So it has nothing to do with sins, but you're celebrating something. You're memorializing something. And what the Lord's Supper is doing is saying, hey, I want you to understand that these events that are about to happen, my being handed over to the Romans to be crucified, which is a murder, the way the language is used there in the Lord's Supper, with blood poured out, as I outline in the book, that this is going to be the release from the curses of the establishment of the new covenant. So we're eating, just like the first Passover was proleptic celebration of the deliverance, just, you know, imminent deliverance. The Lord's Supper, the first one, is a proleptic experience of celebrating the defeat of sin and death and the curses of the covenant, the establishment of the new covenant. So it's through a meal, but the meal itself is not atoning. It's not Jesus' sacrifice that generates this deliverance. It's Jesus' death, as contact with death, that generates the deliverance. So what I think is going on with Jesus' passion is similar to, again, drawing from Matthew Thiessen's work on Jesus and ritual purity and stuff. When Jesus is a potent source of holiness. So when he contacts ritual impurities, he nullifies the sources of these impurities. He overwhelms them with his contagious holiness and purifies them, purifies the and nullifies the contamination. So his contact with death as death is what releases, you know, and then overcoming that in the resurrection is what Jesus' contact with death and then walking out the tomb is the signal that he has overcome the moral impurity, the thing that lead to this sort of covenantal death. And like I said before with Acts 4 and the curses of the covenant. So Jesus is experiencing that. He is contacting the curses of the covenant. He is embedded in experiencing the curses of the covenant, which is the injustice of humans toward humans, which is the injustice of humans and enmity of humans toward God, as I outlined. So he as his contact with that, his full solidarity with that. So that's Jesus' death as death. And that's not Jesus' death as sacrifice. The Lord's Supper is saying, okay, we're going to celebrate that with a sacrificial meal. This is the ultimate Passover. This is the this is the establishment of the new covenant. So it's a celebration. Jesus' death as sacrifice is a celebration of that deliverance. But it's the point is that Jesus' death and resurrection are comprehended within the framework of this moral purification from the prophets, which is distinct from thinking about Jesus in terms of sacrificial imagery. So when it's a sacrificial event, it's viewed as a celebratory memorializing meal for the end of these curses of the covenant brought about. And these curses were, you know, the result of Israel's moral impurity, their sins in those three categories. And so the Lord's Supper is celebrating the end of those. And Jesus as sacrifice is not the saving event itself from that angle. It's just like I said, the first Passover, it's a proleptic ritual celebration of the deliverance that's immediately about to take place because of Jesus' death as death, if that makes sense. So Jesus' death is saving only insofar as it is in tandem, it's conjoined with the resurrection, whereby just how Jesus is encountering major ritual impurities and extinguishing them by his contact, and he's not affected by them. So too, the resurrection's proof that when Jesus encounters death itself, he conquers it. And therefore he must be, so the proclamation goes, the agent, the promised agent of moral purification, the one who's able to forgive the most heinous of sins that drag, you know, the Israel and the whole world and the land into covenant curses of death. Mm-hmm. And that forgiveness is not predicated on a sacrifice, the sacrifice of the Lord's Supper as being a kind of overlay of two communal well-being or non-atoning feasts. Those commemorate that victory over the curses, over sin and death.
Oh, wow. Thank you. That's so interesting. I mean, interesting, maybe it's not the right word because it makes it sound trivial or like, oh, it's a nice thought, but it obviously has so much existential import. And obviously there's some, as you've said already, like there's only so much you can summarize in a podcast, and you're doing a great job doing it. But you know, there's so much more to unravel. So for folks who are interested, I would definitely encourage you to pick up the book. Aside from what we've already discussed, what would you say are maybe some of the inadequacies of thinking of Christ's work on the cross according to this model of substitution? And then I'll combine questions. So it's going to be another big question. I apologize. But so if we're not thinking of Christ's work on the cross as substitution, then how do we think the atonement? And I know that might be overlapping or repetitive with prior questions, but as you said, it's such a dense thicket with the terrain we're in right now. So, such a terminological thicket of words that are used in so many different ways and have such a long history. So maybe it's good to kind of continue to circle around the questions.
Yeah. So as I kind of thread throughout the book, I keep making these nods of like, see, this isn't substitution. See, this isn't substitution. Yeah, Even with the Passover lamb, people are obviously thinking about that. I have a whole long thing on that. Like, again, if you're thinking, it's big. It's a big book. Yeah, and I still feel it's not sufficient. But anyways, like, so I don't know. I can't help myself but just say, like, there's a lot going on here. The problem that I have with substitution, maybe I should start positively. I think at best, the notion of substitution is trying to safeguard, which I agree with, or name the uniqueness, the saving uniqueness, the one-off nature of Jesus's death, or just the saving significance of Jesus, I'll say. And I think that might be why a lot of people want to retain it. They think if you take that away, you're just turning into, again, now this is me having a lay understanding of Abelard, another historical dude, this moral influence theory of atonement. No, I haven't read him that much, so I can't really say if that is a good representation of Abelard or not, but what people think of, like, oh, we're just imitating Jesus or something like that. And so I get that. I get not wanting, right, I get wanting to safeguard the uniqueness of Jesus' saving significance, and I also get wanting to foreclose or head off the danger of thinking, well, if it's not, you know, substitutionary, then it's what, just some sort of example, something like that. Ironically, that's actually the word that First Peter uses, chapter 2, as an example. Okay, well, just throw that out there, like some that's also in the Bible. So, all right. So that positively, so I want to affirm that. I want to be clear before I start knocking on substitution. I agree. I affirm the saving uniqueness of Jesus, the saving uniqueness of Jesus' death. I just don't think substitution is an adequate or accurate way of conceptualizing that uniqueness. And in fact, I don't just think it's inadequate. I think it's very problematic because it obscures how Jesus' death is not just ethically paradigmatic or the pattern. It's also the reality that those united with Jesus literally participate and share in experientially by the Spirit. And I think the concept of substitution grates against that call to participate in the cross, to pick up the cross, to drink of the same cup, to be baptized with his baptism, because it conceptualizes, as I said toward the beginning of this, it conceptualizes Jesus' death as something he endured so that others can avoid it. And I think that is just like spot on what Jesus is critiquing with Peter. Peter knows, he says, you're not going to do this. And he says, get behind me, Satan, right? Mark 8. And then immediately says, not just this is me. He says, this is you. Anyone who wants to follow me needs to pick up the cross and do this. So I really do have like big problems with the notion of substitution. Like I know it's, you're supposed to be like nice and so like, not as like blunt, but like, this is a bad thing, I think. This notion of substitution, I've seen it. I use it as a college pastor, I teach undergrads. It's so hard to get people to think of Jesus as the very one in whose image we are made and meant to conform our lives to. And that's everywhere in the New Testament. And the reason that's a problem is because they say, I've always been taught this is a substitution. All I need to do is believe this. This sounds like salvation by works, sounds like whatever. And it's just a problem. It is a big, big problem. And so, Jesus' death is unique, though. Like I said, I agree with Michael Gorman. Jesus' death is soteriologically, salvifically unique, but it's also ethically paradigmatic, right? It's just because something's unique, though, doesn't mean it's substitutionary. Especially, I deal with Simon Gathercole's book in which it's titled "Defending Substitution." I think, ironically, that he saws off his own the branch he's sitting on there. He has a very good and precise definition of substitution that's logically coherent and sound and all this. And I just go, well, yeah, like that's exactly why I don't think there's substitution in the New Testament. So I want to, again, as I like, so okay, so the problem is a substitution, but like, let me use some analogies I do in the book, which is when someone does something for us that only they can do, we don't always categorize that as substitution. So the example there would be I use as surgeons or rescuing my kids from being knee deep in quicksand when they were like 3 and 5 or something like that, maybe 4 and 6. And when you get in there, quicksand, and rescue them, you're not a substitute. You did something only they can do, or the surgeon's doing something only they can do, but you don't say my substitutionary surgeon, right? You only say that if like you're supposed to have, Dr. Smith, and instead, Dr. whoever, I don't know, Dr. Campbell came in and did it for you. Like, you mean the substitution between the surgeons, not for you, right? So we know that there's ways of people delivering us, rescuing, doing something for our benefit that they are doing for us, but it's not a substitution. And so that's like, again, so I'm just trying to say, like, folks, we have other language for this. Why are we using a word that grates against the call to discipleship and like really puts up these barriers to what is just mm-hmm. explicitly said over and over again in the New Testament? So so I've said enough about why I don't like substitution. But some problems with this, though, is as our relationship goes to Jesus' death, so goes our relationship with the resurrection. That is like also very much embedded all over the place in the New Testament. So there's actually some of these statements about substitution are predicated on an understanding of the Greek preposition huper, and they say, he died for us, that's in our place or whatever. And I just unpack that as like, no, there's no way. Like, that's not how it works. There's so many, if that's what huper means in so many other passages about like just that are seemingly benign, but it just exposes that huper cannot just mean substitution. But one of the big ones comes in 2 Corinthians 5, where Paul says Jesus's resurrection is huper all and us and them. Does that mean Jesus' resurrection is substitutionary? Like, so Jesus was resurrected instead of us? Like, no, no one thinks that. So like, what's going on? So yeah, I think, yeah, there it's participation all the way down. Jesus' death is a sharing in where we already are. He's not doing something that where we're not. He's joining with us, and therefore we get to join with him. A co-crucifixion, Paul says, we're buried with him, raised with him. And that's not just like a metaphor. That's the shape of our life. Paul says in first John, we are walking as he walked. We are picking up our cross. We are drinking the same cup. We are baptized with the same baptism, taking up our cross, the whole bit, all over the place. So what do I think is happening then to close this off here? I've said this a bunch, I think, like this curse, solidarity, atonement. So again, atonement, not as just sacrifice, but as full on reconciliation. I think it goes something more along the lines of this idea, which is sin is ubiquitous, right, in humans. Mm-hmm. So now I'm getting more broad and drawing a lot from Paul's letters here, but sin's domain is the mortal flesh. This is our condemnation to death, and it generates sin and generates our own sinfulness because we are born in this state. And Jesus was truly human in every sort of way. He's made in the likeness of sinful flesh, Romans 8:3. He remained fully obedient within sin's dominion in this flesh, died and was resurrected from the dead. And that means the resurrection means that Jesus has defeated death, broken sin's lordship over mortal flesh. He's broken. If sin leads to death and you've overcome death, you've overcome sin. So this is why Paul says, if Jesus isn't raised, you're still in your sins in 1 Corinthians 15:17. The dying for your sins is in tandem with the resurrection. It's because his death is in solidarity with the death that sin generates that his resurrection releases us from that, as we are only to the extent that we are united with it. Jesus' death and resurrection is a benefit to us only insofar as we are united with it and share in it experientially ourselves. So this newness, if we're united to Jesus' death, then we can walk in the newness of life in Romans 8:6. And we can have a life of obedience like Jesus, putting to death the deeds of the flesh, Romans 8, assured of our own co-resurrection as well. And so at no point would substitution, penal or otherwise, conceptualize what Paul thinks is going on in Christ there. It's not place taking, but place sharing both ways. Yeah. Jesus with us, And us with him. And we're only then, as we are, because Jesus, the Son of God, first shared in our condition, in our cursed condition of humanity, but he was fully obedient, delivered us from that condition in his obedience and resurrection. Only then can we now share and participate in his condition, right? Raised from the dead, seated with Christ in the heavenly places, putting to death the deeds of the flesh. And this is a salvation that is simultaneously transformation. And that's not an extra add-on to what's going on with sure. the saving significance of Jesus. So that's my phrase, saving significance of Jesus, to try to encapsulate the various ways. Again, there's more than just sacrifice going on. I deal with a lot of the passages that people think are about sacrifice but are not. And over again, what we see is there's an emphasis on participation. Jesus' death is unique, or his life, just his total full life, is unique because it creates that reality. He is the condition for our being made anew in the image of God, mm-hmm. in righteousness and holiness and truth, right? In Ephesians 4. And so that it is unique, but you don't call your mother right, your substitutionary person, because she could birth you, right? You can birth yourself. Yeah. Same thing. Only Jesus, we are made in Christ Jesus. We are created in Christ Jesus, Ephesians 2. Born again. So it is unique. He's our creator. He's the one that anchors our humanity in the likeness of God, which is the glory of Christ, as Paul says in 2 Corinthians.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, Andrew, as we come to a close, I want to give you a chance. I like to give all of our guests a chance to share about any works that they have in progress, or is there anything you have in the works, or anything that you'd like to maybe plug here?
So in terms of books, I'm going to return to my dissertation, or I have been slowly, and revising it, adding some things, integrating important studies that have come out since I defended in 2021. So I've been in contact with a couple of different publishers. We'll try to see what goes on with that and how fast I can get those revisions and edits and stuff, all that. And yeah, so that'll be the next big one. I have a couple articles in the pipeline. So see what's going on there. I do want to press into part of my dissertation, and because it's all kind of like in my head, this stuff's all related, even though it looks disparate, but the notions of wrath and judgment in the Apostle Paul, and kind of get into those. I have some things I think I can or want to say on that. Again, mainly again for myself, working some of this stuff out. Yeah. Then hopefully other people find benefit from it. But so nothing like too immediate, but that's what's happening.
Sounds like very interesting.
If people want to follow my musings, they can go on Twitter.
Yes.
Please don't friend me on Facebook. I won't do it. I barely use it, but also so don't be offended. But it's like this old thing. I'm barely on it. It's private. Same thing with Instagram, but Twitter, I use as a sounding board a lot, or Threads. I have an account, but I'm not too active on there. Blue Sky, but we'll see if everything crumbles, I'll probably be more prominent on one of those. But if you want to see what I'm musing about, you can find me on Twitter, Andrew Lera, there.
Awesome. Yeah, we'll leave a link in the show notes as well to your Twitter, not to your private other accounts.
I mean, it's like I don't think I get. I'm just saying, like, I won't do it. I won't. I won't accept your, like, there's this old pictures and stuff, my kids and all. So don't be offended. No. Sorry if you're only on Facebook. If you're in a certain generation or generations, wink, wink. But it's just not where I'm at.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, Andrew, thank you so much for taking the time. I just want to express my appreciation for your thoughtfulness. I thought this was a really interesting conversation. I got the chance to read through the majority of the book. It's a really wonderful book that I'd highly recommend to all our listeners. So be sure to pick it up. It's called, one more time, the name of the book is called Lamb of the Free, Recovering the Varied Sacrificial Understandings of Jesus' Death. Andrew, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate the time.